From the People's Press Project, this is Technical Difficulties.
You can find us online, hashtag Cryptcast, Twitter at LightChronic, Facebook.com, search for Technical Difficulties Radio Show, or you can always find us through the radio station KPPP LP 88.1 FM and KPPPFM.com. Welcome along to the show. This is the first in what I hope will become a long-running series, Technical Difficulties, The Cryptcast. I am a radio journalist, and I proudly follow the credo of nothing about us without us, made famous by others in the disability rights movement. Before I go any further into today's show, I have to tell you that we are going to address the high rate of incarceration and police shootings of disabled people, exacerbated when it comes to communities of colour. I hope to get hold of the authors of a stark report on the subject from the Ruderman Family Foundation. And if you have experienced this abuse, please let me know so you can contribute. We will address these issues in future shows when I, as a long-time but white journalist, have a more detailed grasp of these issues. If you hadn't picked up the accent, I was born in England in the 1980s, with cerebral palsy and hydrocephalus. A little bit more about who I am. Who is this voice emanating from the speaker that you've never heard before? I was born close to London and pretty much bounced around England for education or family life for the first 30-odd years of my life. I then emigrated to Morehead to live with my wife, who is also disabled. Before you wonder why someone with chronic health problems would move from a country with free healthcare to one without, I want to give you an insight into the differences between the British system that I grew up within and the local system for me as a green card holder in Morehead, Minnesota. Despite the National Health Service in England being the biggest employer in the UK, it is over 99% taxpayer funded, and therefore it is subject to the whims and public squabbling between politicians and the public about how much of, quote, taxpayers' money, unquote, they give to the service. The whole idea of taxpayers' money being an issue for healthcare systems is obviously a slightly flawed concept, given that quite a lot of those using the system either currently pay tax or have previously done so. Anyway, it has been chronically underfunded for years and is set to get more so since the current government in the UK is conservative and therefore wants to cut rather than raise taxes. My lifespan has basically charted the years of declining funding within the National Health Service. Therefore, when I was born, the perinatal intensive care was outstanding, and it literally saved my life. Although it has since been established that my major diagnoses were 2 years late. Despite that, I felt well cared for. And despite me moving across England, I received a comprehensive occupational therapy which taught me how to eat and dress myself, and speech therapy, which my family joke went too well. Even at this stage of apparently comprehensive care, my mental health was not addressed and my mostly paralysed left arm was essentially ignored. These oversights or gaps in an overstretched, under-resourced system would later be exposed. At the age of 16, I was discharged from paediatric care with no adult referral and spat out into the adult healthcare world without any ongoing care. The dirty secret is that the shining and very extensive crown jewel of the National Health Service drops the ball when it comes to lifelong care, and it has absolutely no history of researching adult experience from CP from which to develop treatment plans. A few years following my discharge from paediatric PT in particular, I fell down a flight of concrete stairs at a soccer stadium in England, and it was only during this traumatic injury that it was revealed that the gap in physical therapy and more obviously guidance, had caused my leg muscles to atrophy. But the NHS would only cover 8 weeks of physical therapy, and I was discharged once again, despite the obviously long-term issues that needed addressing. About 5 years ago, this chronic lack of care revealed itself again, and my leg muscles became so painful that following an 8-hour shift by a computer was followed by excruciating pain and the closest I've ever been to killing myself. Even at this crisis point, diagnosed Valium and off work on sick leave, my mental health was not addressed by any of my doctors, and I was left to find a private practitioner and begin the long road back to good mental health. As I said, the long-term impact on mental health of a physical disability is massively under-researched, and I have no reason to believe that this is any worse or better in the US, I have to say, but I have personal experience of it being poorly researched in the UK. And then, with all my ducks in a row in one of the most hectic cities in the world, I then caused my next problem by falling in love with a woman who lives in Moorhead, Minnesota, and then having to address the vagaries and specifics of immigration and healthcare and how they intersect. Whilst I am a white English guy, there are still some things which are universal in the experience of immigration to a new country. Did you know there is no mechanism for carrying your health records to a new home country? The National Health Service in the UK bluntly refused to give me a copy of my health records. They charged me £90 for a cursory summary copy for my immigration paperwork and completely refused to give me a copy of my complete medical record, instead filing it away in a dusty warehouse in the north of England. Therefore, I arrived in my new home country just over a year ago, with zero medical records. In my opinion, the era of the Affordable Care Act in the United States has given the potential for providers to serve everyone, and once the state of Minnesota declared me eligible for state health care due to my low income, my local provider was more than willing to measure, test, and treat a range of health problems. The occupational therapist I saw told me my left arm could be used if I wanted and that my eyes weren't lining up, a problem swiftly fixed by a neurooptometrist within the same system. My physical therapist immediately spotted that an ankle-foot orthosis would help with my muscle atrophy and fatigue. My neurologist in Sanford, Fargo, spotted a bleed on a routine brain scan. It had been there for 30 years and was benign, but had never been spotted in England. She also prescribed an anti-anxiety medication with a side effect of drowsiness to help me switch off at night. My physiatrist gave me a cortisone shot into my left arm to deal with the impinged nerves in that least cooperative corner of my body. And there were many others in an intensive 6-month run of appointments who fixed a large number of unnecessary symptoms that had been allowed to prevail during the disconnect between myself and healthcare services. The last piece of the incoming immigrant puzzle would have been a resumption of talking therapy, but then the state of Minnesota revoked my insurance. Another dirty secret when comparing the US to the UK? Prescription medication is much cheaper under Minnesota's state-sponsored healthcare than it ever was in my lifetime under the National Health Service. Just for those of you listening who don't know me, just to clarify once more, I am an engaged user of healthcare systems, and the fact that these things were allowed to lapse was not my fault, and I fear the reflection on people who are less vocal and less able than I am, if I was allowed to lapse. Despite the Affordable Care Act, I am uninsured right now because the state of Minnesota lost track of my details, had one system saying that I was covered, which was the one that the pharmacies and doctors read, and one system saying that they weren't covering me, which was the one that the state was reading, And 3 months after the two systems stopped communicating with each other, they decided to pull the plug on me. It was their mistake, they lost my details, and yet I had to reapply to fix their mistake. I have reapplied. I'm now in limbo, waiting for clearance. I've been told that I'm eligible, but I'm waiting for a fresh white piece of paper that says I'm eligible once more, and then I can refill my prescriptions for muscle relaxants and pain medication, which are running out at the moment. In 2014, I married my wife in Island Park in Fargo. She is a natural-born US citizen and I am not. I was required to then stay in England until I got my green card. Our marriage is a reflection of our age. Founded on Twitter, Skype, and Facebook, and then grown in the permafrost of the Red River Valley in post-9/11 America, it and we were subjected to complex and long-winded processes of verification, some of which still remain in play, before I was cleared to migrate and then become a lawful permanent resident. I shudder to think of the additional scrutiny that people who aren't white men from England attract in these proceedings. Interestingly, the chronic health problems that I have outlined are seemingly of little interest to the Department of Homeland Security or the State Department at federal level. Thankfully, I have no cognitive disabilities that would bring me into the crosshairs of law enforcement seeking compliant people, and neither does Sonia. I'm not neurotypical, however, and such demands of blanket obedience don't sit well with my hyper-rationality. Whilst there were no roadblocks at federal level, the state of Minnesota is a different matter. A letter in July told me I was eligible for Minnesota care, then one in August said my cover was being cancelled, a county social services employee suggested it was not being cancelled, and a final letter in late September confirmed the cancellation. I have just spent some $300 on muscle relaxants and nerve pain medication out of my own pocket, when with state assistance they cost $6 in total. Another thing governments don't want to acknowledge, without those meds I would not be contributing any tax to state or federal budgets. In the US, as in Britain, tax-cutting zealots want to cut funding to programs such as the National Health Service and Medicare, which enable more disabled people to work, pay tax, and generally be productive members of society. It makes me furious. US citizens who earn $4,000 a year qualify for medical assistance, a category with a much reduced co-payment compared to Minnesota care. Immigrants such as myself are barred from medical assistance for 5 years, a seemingly arbitrary length of time if the aim is to prevent immigrants from claiming from the state. The rules make zero sense. After all, my Minnesota care categorization does include state-subsidized healthcare. Nonetheless, I shouldn't really complain about being classified in an artificially inflated position relative to my income. The state of Minnesota yanked my insurance completely last week. Their explanation, like much of this stuff, just made me angry and confused at the very time that I couldn't fulfill my psychological therapy appointment without paying hundreds of dollars out of pocket. Here's the dirty truth of disability classification, whether it's for a bus pass or health insurance. Many, if not most, disabled people will never complete the process because being constantly asked to tell a stranger, even in writing, that you cannot do things is degrading and damaging to mental and physical well-being. I credit my occupational therapist at Sanford Fargo and my primary healthcare physician for helping me through the paperwork I have needed, but I have not applied for SSDI and I am not alone. I can only give you my experience. I've been on this beat since college, in and out of the studios of Resonance 104.4 FM in London and the Paralympics. I originally broadcast technical difficulties for them. It started out as an avenue for disability affairs news, and then the government in the UK introduced a bill proposing widespread reduction in disability benefits, and our show began to give a voice to the protesters. When I migrated to Moorhead, we had to reassess the domestic context of this house, which has been in my wife's family for years, and work out whether there were any adjustments that were needed to cope with my more extreme physical demands. The main thing to come out of that consideration was a motorized bed frame, and a new memory foam mattress to duplicate the one that I had in the UK. The motorized bed frame was and is a godsend and can pretty much place the bed at any angle you want it to, helping with blood flow and muscle tension overnight. None of the cost of this bed was picked up by my insurance, despite all of the need being medical. I thank my family for their assistance in helping pay for this. I mentioned during my conversation about cerebral palsy with Sonia that I had a free bus pass for the buses in London, paid for out of London Council taxation funds, which, as I pointed out earlier on, includes me. To a certain extent, I was able to duplicate this when I moved to Moorhead. The MAT Parabus functions door-to-door, and I was allowed eligibility for this with thanks to my occupational therapist for helping me through the assessment process, and I was also given the accompanying discount card for entry on the normal buses. That said, Moorhead and Fargo do not have anywhere near the extent of a public transit system that London has, but it's better than nothing. I would also add the London Pass gave me free access to this transport, whereas everything in Fargo Moorhead costs me money, even though a journey on a fixed bus only costs 75 cents. I have mentioned that I got married in Fargo. You will hear from my beautiful bride on that warm day. Sonia K. Peterson became Sonia K. Abbott. She has endometriosis, fibromyalgia, and other things I have probably forgotten. And earlier this year, she had her last ovary removed and is navigating hormone replacement therapy. As I said earlier, I met her on Twitter because she followed the Technical Difficulties account and because we both support the same baseball team. She used to work retail and then endometriosis happened and she has been unable to work consistently since. What followed was a decade of surgeries and that US citizen path to medical assistance from the state of Minnesota. Our house is pretty much a mobile pharmacy, even though after the surgery, some of the medications have come off my wife's list. Don't get me wrong, it could be worse. I could live in the less supportive environment of North Dakota. I told you at the top of the show I have two key conditions: cerebral palsy and hydrocephalus. For the rest of the show, I'm dipping into my archives and bringing you conversations I had on the subject of those two conditions on the original series of Technical Difficulties. It broadcast on another non-profit radio station, Resonance 104.4 FM in London. I thank them for their assistance. I will be back live at the end with information that brings those clips up to date. We are joined by Sonia K. Peterson. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Tim, and you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Before we get into your own personal history, tell us a bit about cerebral palsy.
Well, in the EU, it is an average of 2 babies per 1,000 live births that have the condition. That's the highest rate within the EU is actually in the UK. It's 2.3 per 1,000. And those figures were from 1990. And mostly the live births, the babies that survive, are moderate, not severe. The reason for that? The statistics on babies with a very low birth weight, which is less than 1.5 kilos, 3 pounds, colloquially a bag of sugar, is that 52%, so over half, of babies born with a very low birth weight, so less than a bag of sugar, die in the neonatal stage. So that is intensive care when they're having all the treatment necessary to keep them alive, having usually been born prematurely. So that's the background. I am therefore in the 48%, so again, less than half, of those that actually survived that experience. I was a very low birth weight baby, and somehow I got out of there.
So is this something that you can inherit, or is it something that happens after you're born prematurely?
Primarily, it's triggered by premature birth. There have been more studies into acquired cerebral palsy in adult life, but for the purposes of this program, we're going to stick with the conventional definition, and that is that it is caused by the immaturity of the brain from a premature birth, and therefore, if you're born early, things haven't developed properly, and so parts of your mind don't work, and therefore parts of your body don't work. Damage to the cerebellum, which causes movement disorders, is the definition of cerebral palsy, and so brain damage causing a lack of functionality in the body, and it is absolutely to do with premature birth, and you absolutely categorically cannot inherit it or catch it or under most circumstances develop it.
What was it like in your early years as you were growing up with CP?
As I said, the first thing that happened was there was the trauma as I was born. A couple of years, I was in and out of hospital having revisions and checks and stuff done to the various secondary ailments, of which the most prominent is hydrocephalus. And then things basically settled down. So at the start of the regular schooling system, I was in regular schooling. I wasn't in special schools or special educational needs systems. And so really, it was an invisible condition for most people. I knew what I was dealing with. The most anyone else knew about it was that as the years wore on, I kept disappearing off in the middle of school days to go to hospital for checkup appointments and for physio and to a place in semi-rural West Lancashire where I grew up called the Child Development Centre at the hospital where all the paediatric specialists were. And so, yeah, they gave me various kinds of therapy to deal with things, but those all happened outpatient. So they gave me those therapies whilst I could have been at school doing academic things. I got sort of parachuted out and then dropped back into a system where everyone else had been learning all day. And so it was frankly, a very disruptive way of doing it.
Oh, I bet. Were your friends and family supportive of you when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, my family have been superb in terms of their support, their protection of me and support for progress. I think the fairest way to put it would be that the negatives are something we all have to deal with ourselves. But the positives, they gave lots of support for. In the dark days when the lights are off and you're sitting in a room on your own, the only person who can support yourself is you.
Right.
And so that's where friends come in. Friends can be with you in those rooms without it feeling like you're having to abandon your privacy, which is often an issue with families and that kind of intimacy issue. Not the same with friends. You can sit and talk to your friends about these things and feel more comfortable about it. And that's probably how I got through my teenage years, was talking to friends about this, or developing friendships and talking to people about these things. And maybe, I actually don't recall talking to many people about it, but maybe it was the reassurance that there was a social life for somebody who wasn't really able to have a social life in the real world, that actually having the friendships that I developed over distance and online were the fallback, the safety net for those to tell me it was possible to live a life, even if it wasn't someone else's definition of one.
Right. So you mentioned the dark days sitting in your room alone with the light off. Was your mental health taken into consideration as you were growing up with CP?
No. To be absolutely honest, no. I don't recall, and I apologise to any of the doctors that I've dealt with in my life if this is a conversation I just don't remember, but I don't recall anyone even asking me whether I needed to speak to a counsellor. My first engagement with psychological therapy was after a completely unrelated set of circumstances in my adult life that's completely irrelevant to this conversation. Now being in therapy, realised how much of this stuff needed to be dealt with and hadn't been for nearly 30 years. It was a very unholistic approach. It was speech therapy because I couldn't talk. It was physiotherapy because I couldn't walk very well when I started. It was occupational therapy because I couldn't eat because, you know, how do you eat with one hand? And so they taught me how to eat one-handed and how to do my clothes up and things. They didn't see a psychological problem. They could hear how erudite I was, and so they didn't feel the need to give me psych therapy or to offer it.
But now that you have it, it does help?
Yeah, it does, because realizing that it helps just to have a knowledgeable but non-judgmental voice in the room, I think. And however supportive my family and friends are, they generally don't have the knowledge base.
Right.
They certainly don't have the knowledge base of self-esteem problems that my therapist understands and can help me with. The biggest symptom of my form of cerebral palsy is that one side of my body is... the nerve pathways are heavily impaired, and so messages don't get from the brain to the muscles very easily. I said about eating one-handed. I can't really do many things with both hands, and so I don't feel normal. And so trying to settle into most situations is exactly what I need to do. I have to settle in. I can't just walk into a room with people I don't know and be fine with it. I'm not sure I'm over it yet, to be honest with you, but I'm better at it. I was joking with you earlier on, Sonia, that doing this show means I can hide behind the professional veil to a degree and be an activist. I'm hoping that those of you listening to this show today get an idea of what it's like to be dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. I'll be honest, the psychology is an interesting one because I'm a survivor out of a group that's less than half. So I do feel survivor's guilt, and I think that's probably quite a big part of it.
Can you kind of walk us through a typical day for you and how CP affects normal things that, you know, normal people just do without thinking?
Yeah, absolutely. With pleasure. I'll just pause to remind everyone this is Technical Difficulties. I am series producer Tim Abbott. I am stepping back and being the guest in the company of my partner, Sonia K. Peterson. So, yeah, my typical day. Okay, getting out of bed is a challenge because levering yourself upright requires leverage. People with normal muscle development can just get up. I don't think they need to lever themselves upright off the bed. Because I'm lopsided, I have to lever myself upright pretty much. I can't just stand up because there's not enough strength in my core. When I put my feet on the ground, it often hurts because my muscles have been cramping. Spasticity is basically like a severe form of cramp, and spasticity is a symptom of the condition I have, and so my muscles will tense up when I try and wake up. And so that is the start to the day. Teeth brushing and eating is fine, but that's because of occupational therapy, and I'm thankful for that. But I do only use one arm to eat. I swap cutlery around. And honestly, on a bad day, I get up and don't shower or get up and don't have breakfast because I just don't have the spoons, to use Christine Mizarandino's expression, to handle it when I'm already in pain. A brief side note, as somebody with mild cerebral palsy for until about 5 years ago, I wasn't in pain. But I still struggled to look after myself because I may not have been in physical pain. I still felt inadequate.
Right.
When I was thinking about things like showering and eating. And so even if it didn't hurt, it was bothering me that it took so much effort to actually do these things. Getting dressed as well. I mean, I get up, put my clothes on, but I put my clothes on kind of methodically because I've been taught how to dress in a particular way. And then I get on a bus, which is paid for by the municipal government because I can't walk very well. I have to explain, cerebral palsy is a non-progressive condition, but there is this secondary phase known in the UK at least as post-impairment syndrome, but known by every physiotherapist I've ever met in my life as burnout. The reason it's called burnout is because when you've got cerebral palsy, you don't put the weight in the right places, because it's like a lightning rod and lightning strike. A lightning rod brings stuff the quickest way to the ground. Electricity follows the path of least resistance, as do electrical things in the body. And so if you've got a tense muscle, the electrical stimulation will go into a different muscle. And so you'll learn these patterns of movement that make you even more wonky and asymmetrical. After you make yourself more asymmetrical, you just discover that parts of you are starting to wear out. And that is because the leg muscles are worn out. It is a spasticity issue. I have the medication that treats the spasticity cramp and reduces it, but it also makes the muscles even weaker. But burnout is also a problem with the top half of my body, shoulder muscles and arm muscles. On the otherwise reliable, supposedly non-damaged side of my body, I've been using it for everything for nearly 30 years, and so it's now worn out. And there isn't spasticity issues with that. It is just literally wear and tear, and it's 30 years of wear and tear doing everything with those muscles. Burnout is something that I'm so glad I remembered to mention, because it is something people need to understand. I often say cerebral palsy is like a non-progressive multiple sclerosis, but non-progressive does not mean it does not get worse. It means the damage is caused once, and that is something people need to bear in mind when they look at people getting worse, especially in the context of governments threatening disability benefit. Need to be aware that no condition in the world is static. People don't live in a bubble. I have a memory foam mattress because I need the orthopedic support. The UK has a socialized medical system, but I paid for my therapy, I paid for my mattress, I paid for my walking stick, because there's just no onward care. The people in the system just expect people with cerebral palsy either not to survive, or there's just not been research into adult cerebral palsy. And so being an adult with cerebral palsy means I'm basically pushing through all this stuff myself, generally.
Right.
With the help, to be fair, of the neurophysiotherapists, who are the experts in the area, who I've just rediscovered recently as a consequence of the burnout taking hold. To cross jurisdictions for a moment, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta did research in 1996. Yeah, I think it's 1996. Certainly 90s or early 2000s. Found that the cost of cerebral palsy was $921,000 over a lifetime.
Is that cost of just medicines and care and appointments, or is that lost wages because of the CP?
It's everything. It's the additional costs. They assessed lost employment opportunities, but also all the other costs I've spoken about: medication, movement aids, therapy for those people that aren't covered by the social medicine net.
From listening to the show today, what do you want people to take away from your experience and your story?
I think I want people to understand that lifelong conditions require lifelong care, but also that things that are worn as badges of pride by us that are born with, I will say it in a moment when I sign off the show, I wear these conditions with pride, but does not mean ever that someone doesn't need help, doesn't need support, doesn't need people to be aware that there are issues there. I often say to people, the old situation of someone looks like they're struggling, do you offer help? Always offer help. They can always say no to you.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get offended if they say no to you. But personally, I would rather the whole world just asked those questions all the time, to the point where it might get annoying that it was asked too much, because it's certainly not where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Society is not asking these questions all the time. So yeah, awareness is the thing I want people to take away from it. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Oh, you're most welcome, Tim. Thank you for sharing your story, your experiences, and your views on cerebral palsy.
Technical difficulties?
When I see pushing down your faith. And when you think that there's no tomorrow, allow me there to comfort you. Allow me there to drown your sorrow. And with tears, with tears of laughter, or tomorrow looks so bad, and we'll live to fight another day.
You just heard Sarah and Jess Renahan with Sorrow. Sarah and myself both share a journey with the brain condition hydrocephalus, and I'm hoping that by the end of today's show you will know more about it than you do now. In order to cast some light on it, I'm joined in the studio here by Jill Yaz from the Association for Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus.
Hello, Tim. Thank you.
Now, the most obvious first question is, what is it?
Hydrocephalus is a condition where fluid that's made in the middle of your brain gets trapped, and it can cause pressure. We all have spaces in our brains that we don't often aware of, and fluid is made and absorbed. If anything gets trapped or not absorbed, pressure can build up and become trapped, and it can cause some damage to the brain.
Is it common?
It is more common than you'd think for something that a lot of people haven't heard of, Tim. There's about 1 in 1,000 people in this country that have got it for one reason or another. It can actually happen before birth. There's quite a lot of babies being born with it, developing in the womb with it, born with it, and having to have it treated straight away. A lot of premature babies have hydrocephalus too. Then later on through our lives, tumours are detected, little cysts in the brain all take up space and they can trap the fluid. And then later on in the life, even so, hopefully, this head injury is any brain surgery can cause it. And in middle years, brain bleeds can also gum up the absorption of it. So it's right the way through, really, the length of your lives.
If you suspect that you're listening to this show and that you think that that sounds like someone you know, it might be yourself. What are the signs?
In children and small babies, you tend to get an increase in the head circumference, and the babies would be quite unwell-looking, not feeding properly, sleepy, lethargic babies who cry a lot, with a head that's increasing in size, with little veins appearing. But later on, once the bones are set, Tim, in your head, then the pressure rises quite quickly if the fluid gets trapped, and that can cause you to become very unwell, sometimes over years, but more often over months and weeks, with severe headaches, vomiting, drowsiness, and it can become very serious if it's not treated.
How do you treat it?
The most common way of treating it at the moment is via shunt, which is a thin silicone tube. To look at, they look like a piece of cooked spaghetti, about that kind of size, that just passes in through the skull into the ventricles to drain the fluid off, usually into the space around the outside of the bowel, which is called the peritoneal cavity. But they can end up in other places. They can drain the fluid off and the body just deals with it naturally, just absorbs it, returns it back into the bloodstream.
For those of us listening to the show, and I'll include myself in this, who've been diagnosed with it and been treated for it, what do you do afterwards and what's the long-term coping strategy?
I think once people have had a shunt, especially in their adult lives, it can be very difficult for people to get used to the idea that you need this piece of silicone tube in to stay alive. And people can feel quite depressed and angry about that for a while. But I think in the long term, it's actually managing, finding out how does your body cope with it? Are there things, if you overdo it, do you get headachy? Do you need to drink more, eat a little bit more frequently? Maybe just to just pace your life a little bit. But it's learning what feels right for your body. Sometimes people with hydrocephalus get a lot of headaches, even if their shunt is working completely fine. And that can be managed. Take specialist advice on that. Get yourself referred to a headache clinic or something.
Is it similar then to managing a traumatic brain injury then?
Traumatic brain injuries, yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, it might have effects on the way your brain does things. The hydrocephalus can affect your memory, for example. And just how you find things, the way you organise your thing. Just have a little sit down and think about how do you do things, what are going to help. So sometimes people find they get very frustrated if they can't remember things and they just keep on trying to remember things and they can't. So just try and find, if I can't remember, what can I do? How can I reach the same end result and function and live my life? Maybe I need to do something slightly differently to other people, but what might that be? Talk through with friends and relatives about how they perceive and to see if they've got any suggestions, using things like email for reminders, texts, phone alarms, those sorts of things, just to remind you. But I think as well, just to be mindful that, you know, sometimes shunts do go wrong, and just to let people, some people close to you, know to look out for some of the signs that you might be coming a bit unwell and need some treatment, because you might not recognise it yourself.
Does it cause problems with security checks? I mean, it's made out of silicon, so I don't expect it would trigger a metal detector or
the
anything.
The ordinary ones don't, but there are some shunts where a valve is controlled by a little magnetic device and it can be changed. And sometimes, every now and again, these programmable shunts, the magnet can get changed by the security gates. So if you're ever looking for not to go through a knife arch, there it is.
So what happens then?
You take some information saying that it's not a good idea. If it says these gates are not a good idea, if you've got a pacemaker, then you should avoid them as well. But only for some people with these programmable shunts, and they all know who they are as well. But the shunts are getting better. It doesn't often happen. It's just a precaution.
Leaving aside the worrying prospect of a metal detector setting off your programmable shunt, if you think that you're not well, or you're listening to this again and you think someone in your family who has that history, has hydrocephalus and has had a shunt, that something's wrong, what are the signs of malfunction in the shunt?
The signs of malfunction, especially in adults, would be quite a rapid deterioration for most people in how conscious they are. Sometimes people get headaches, sometimes they don't, sometimes they vomit, sometimes they don't. But over a period of time, people with shunt blockages that are going to make them ill will become quite drowsy and start losing consciousness. And that's the time to really act, because for most people whose shunts are taking all the fluid out of their heads, you've really got about a 4-hour window before you should get to your neurosurgeon. But for a lot of people, again, sort of especially people that have had shunts in for a couple of decades, sometimes the body finds its own way of dealing with the fluid without the shunt. So sometimes, you know, even if your shunt isn't actually working, if you find it on an x-ray and it's become disconnected, but if you're all right, then everything is all right.
People have said that to me in examinations. I had mine put in 1984, and I've had one operation to put it in and never had a revision. And I suspect, and some neurosurgeons have said this to me, that the body has adapted around the situation. What do you do in that circumstance? You go straight to a hospital.
If you're unwell, yes, you should. If you can get to your neurosurgical unit safely and quickly with some information about their shunt and say, I suspect there's a shunt blockage.
You're listening to Technical Difficulties. We are discussing hydrocephalus, which is not uncommon, is an expression I've heard.
Not uncommon.
But not very well known. How common is it statistically?
And it's quite a lot. Half of all children's neurosurgery is shunt related or hydrocephalus related.
What is the rate of failure then? I'll explain to the listeners. I was talking about this before as possibly the most common anxiety provoking thing in my healthcare life, is the fact that I have this thing in my head and I have no idea what the failure rate is. And I know that that is quite a common concern amongst other people with hydros. What are the statistics on that?
The statistics on that, they're quite interesting, because if shunts are going to go wrong, statistically they've got much higher chance of going wrong in the first 6 months. As they're draining out fluid, your brain changes shape, little bits of tissue can get clogged up in it as that happens. So I think 3/4 of any shunt failures happen in that first 6 months. Infection used to be a part of the reason why they went wrong, which only happens in the very early weeks of a shunt. But we've got shunts now with antibiotics impregnated actually into the silicone, which is called Bactisil, which is a real breakthrough for that. Some people are unlucky and they have to have revision after revision, but that's mostly children. And I think for the statistics is that after 5 years in children, 56% of shunts will still be surviving, and for adults there's 32% failure rate in the first 5 years, and then after that it's a steady about 5% every year that do fail and need to be replaced. So though it causes a lot of anxiety, and I think people do need to take it seriously, in my experience it doesn't matter how long you've had a shunt, you can never say it'll never pack up or you don't need it anymore. And we have had a few cases where people have had their fingers burnt by not taking that. Oh, I've had it since I was 3 months old and I'm 30 now, and then suddenly it's gone. You always need to have it in the back of your mind that it could be a problem. But I think the statistics, they're not that unreliable. They very rarely go wrong in themselves. It's usually tissue blocking up or something blocking them up. Part of your body will be blocking them up. The valves that control the flow are very reliable. It's not as bad as the press gets, but there are a few unlucky people who have had multiple revisions over their lives, 40 or 50, which is very sad.
I think 30% is quite a high percentage, though, for something to fail.
Over 5 years, and that's, but 3/4 of those will be in the first 6 months. So they're quite reliable. As a rate after that, after the first year, it's about 5% a year.
Is it sort of symptomatic of complicated medical procedures in general? Do you think there's more failure and more problems in less developed countries with less developed healthcare systems?
The access to this kind of surgery in the developing world is very poor, and it's a matter of concern. There are some doctors that are pioneering some procedures for use, for example, in Africa, where people won't be able to get back to a neurosurgical centre, something that's permanent, but it's a big problem.
Yeah, because infrastructure, I mean, I remember thinking this before, that there are circumstances where the transport network is vital for you to be able to actually still be alive. If it's a 4-hour window, then being 4 hours from a hospital is quite a challenge in quite a lot of places. And you're right, there's just not. I wonder, is it the case that you've got a finite number of experts as well? And so you've got to get to one of those people. It's not like you can just turn up.
Oh, you can't just turn up any. Yeah. You turn up at your GP and say, right.
Yeah, I need a shunt revision, please. Yeah.
There is an international federation, if global it's called. It's a confederation of like-minded organisations going all over the world, and especially in the developing world, for people to get together to push to find ways of getting treatments and getting the conditions recognised. I did meet a lady in Great Ormond Street. I think she was from Nigeria, and she was a journalist. Her son had hydrocephalus, and she was going to go and use the radio station because she said in the villages everyone's got a radio if you haven't got anything else, and she said she was going to use it to actually get the message out that it was treatable. A lot of countries, the babies will die. People don't know that it's treatable, or they haven't got access to that treatment.
I mean, we were discussing this before, the dynamics of the condition. In quite a lot of situations, if you say a person has too much of a fluid in their body, then they tap a hole and drain it out. Ask the question, why is that not something you would do with hydrocephalus?
Well, the shunt more or less does that. You are making a hole into the cavity where the fluid's getting trapped, and you're just draining it. But you're just draining it in a closed way. If you just made a hole, you would have to stop bacteria getting in. You would have to be able to control the fluid getting in. Otherwise, your head would just collapse because the fluid is under some pressure. But most of it's bacteria. If you had that, you would get meningitis and encephalitis, and you'd become very ill.
And that presumably is an issue in areas where there's not the developed healthcare system, that they have to resolve the issue within that window or the person will die, but they might not have the infrastructure to install the shunt.
I think so, and just even getting the message out that it's a treatable condition. And in a lot of places in Africa, most common cause is infection in the babies, either before birth or during birth, and they're usually very sick babies in the first place.
Yeah, and it's not easy to operate on a child that's already ill.
No.
I'll say briefly, actually, it's not evident right now. I was saying to Jill before that my hair's longer than it has been at some times, but I posted a photograph online of what the scar on my head normally looks like when my hair is short. And gotta be honest, Sarah Renahan's scar beats mine hands down. She even had a mohawk cut onto her hair to raise money to illustrate it.
Oh,
and
wow.
Given where the scar is, and that is on one side of the head, that means it's very, very visible. A fantastic piece of awareness raising. I'd just like to get into the association and your background as an institution and what you're going to be doing going on.
Well, the most exciting thing that we're going to be doing, which I have to mention now before I get onto the background, is we're going to be coming out next month as SHINE, which stands for Spina Bifida Hydrocephalus Information Network and Equality. We're going to raise our profile so that more people do find out about the conditions, but more people can come, network with each other and gain that support that you can only really get from people who've had similar experiences to yourselves. We're going to be encouraging that. But the organisation really grew up, I think, in the 1960s from groups of parents whose children, having had the benefit of a very new treatment for the hydrocephalus, were the first ones to survive in any numbers. And they were being left in the 1960s with no support to cope with their children's conditions or disabilities, and things that we now take for granted through the hard fights of a lot of people with disabilities that they didn't have, the things that they had to fight for and campaign for and get the information themselves. We've grown up really from them.
The association has two conditions in its title, and they both translate into the new institution as well, spina bifida and hydrocephalus. Now, we've spoken quite a lot about hydrocephalus.
Yeah.
What is spina bifida and why does it relate to hydrocephalus?
Right. Spina bifida is a condition that affects the development of the spinal cord in the back, and that happens very beginning of the pregnancy and can cause a lot of significant physical disabilities, where hydrocephalus can affect mostly the way you learn, remember, and those things. But spina bifida can affect the way your movement, mobility, your skin, can affect your bladder and bowel function, all lots of different things. The association between the two conditions is that most people with open forms of spina bifida also have hydrocephalus. So there was a big group of people who came with the two conditions, and it's actually very difficult. One has a knock-on effect on the other. If you've got physical impairment, there might be more things that you have to do to care for yourself properly, remember to do, to keep healthy. And if you're memory is affected, then that might be harder. That's how the two things grew. But lots of people have got spina bifida on its own, that's fine. Lots of people have got hydrocephalus on its own, and that's fine too.
It's always useful in these circumstances to look forward. We've covered how things have progressed. So what would you wish to be going forward? What is your target for SHINE? What would you hope to see?
I'd hope to see a big raising of an awareness of the two conditions, so that people, you know, for children going through school, more people are aware of how the people might be affected. A lot more sensitive handling, you know, that people who look like other people, in inverted commas, there are lots of hidden disabilities there, and I'd like everybody to have an access to the support that they need to thrive and do well and succeed. We've got a Go Folic campaign as well to encourage women of childbearing ages to actually take folic acid. Lots of people know they're meant to be taking it, but it can help to prevent your pregnancy being affected by spina bifida. So I'd just like to flag that up.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for joining us, Jill Yaz, from the Association for Spina Bifida and Hydrocephalus, soon to be SHINE. Thank you for listening. Sarah Renahan's site is projectbraindrain.org. So to bring you the context of those two interviews, originally conducted from a British perspective on Resonance 104.4 FM in London, both cerebral palsy and hydrocephalus are pretty static conditions across two countries who have a fair amount of culture in common. However, figures from the National Institutes of Health give 3.5 out of every 1,000 live births in the US as people with cerebral palsy. They add, whilst the number of survivors generally remains static, racial disparities exist and have persisted over time between non-Hispanic black and Hispanic white children, with a prevalence rate of 1.8 to 1. Different patterns emerge for non-Hispanic white and non-Hispanic children by birth weight and gestorial age, they add. That would seem to unfortunately reiterate the truth that race plays into everything. The prevalence of hydrocephalus in the US is 0.82 per 1,000 live births. For more details on hydrocephalus, you can go to www.hydroassoc.org. That's hydroassoc.org. Resonance 104.4 FM can be reached at resonance.fm. SHINE can be reached at shinecharity.org.uk. And for a more comprehensive look at the world of living with invisible disabilities, please visit www.butyoudontlooksick.com.
From the miniature, 3, 2, 1, now it's time to get more immature. We need to read more literature. They smell like vinegar. Ward picketers can't even show it anymore, cause they're sick of her. Black magic, but I'm wickeder. Dag nabbit, fuck a bigoter. Bad habit is a hatchet man. Savage tatted like a listener. This ain't Christopher Williams. Still some people need to feel some real dish chill, so we'll heal some.
That was our good friends, the awesome Wheelchair Sports Camp versus Radiohead with 15 Steps from the Mixed Tapes album. Wheelchair Sports Camp has a new album out right now called No Big Deal. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining me. For everyone here at 88.1 FM KPPPLP, adding local colour to the airwaves, I'm Tim Abbott. Wear your scars with pride. And remember, we all have technical difficulties. Goodbye.